7 days in May. Thursday, May 23rd. At his regular Thursday meeting with his top lieutenants in the McIntosh division, Jobs told his inner circle about his plan to oust Scully. He also confided in the corporate human resources director, Jay Elliott, who told him bluntly that the proposed rebellion wouldn't work. Elliott had talked to some board members and urged them to stand up for Jobs, but he discovered that most of the board was with Scully, as were most members of Apple's senior staff. Yet Jobs barreled ahead. He even revealed his plans to Jean-Louis Gasset on a walk around the parking lot, despite the fact that Gasset had come from Paris to take his job. "I made the mistake of telling Gasset," Jobs wryly conceded years later. That evening, Apple's general counsel, Al Eisenstadt, had a small barbecue at his home for Scully, Gasset, and their wives. When Gasset told Eisenstadt what Jobs was plotting, he recommended that Gasset inform Scully. "Steve was trying to raise a cabal and have a coup to get rid of John," Gasset recalled. In the den of Al Eisenstadt's house, I put my index finger lightly on John's breastbone and said, "If you leave tomorrow for China, you could be ousted. Steve's plotting to get rid of you." Friday, May 24th. Scully canceled his trip and decided to confront Jobs at the executive staff meeting on Friday morning. Jobs arrived late, and he saw that his usual seat next to Scully, who sat at the head of the table, was taken. He sat instead at the far end. He was dressed in a well-tailored suit and looked energized. Scully looked pale. He announced that he was dispensing with the agenda to confront the issue on everyone's mind. "It's come to my attention that you'd like to throw me out of the company," he said, looking directly at Jobs. "I'd like to ask you if that's true." Jobs was not expecting this, but he was never shy about indulging in brutal honesty. His eyes narrowed, and he fixed Scully with his unblinking stare. "I think you're bad for Apple, and I think you're the wrong person to run the company," he replied, coldly and slowly. "You really should leave this company. You don't know how to operate, and never have." He accused Scully of not understanding the product development process, and then he added a self-centered swipe. "I wanted you here to help me grow, and you've been ineffective in helping me." As the rest of the room sat frozen, Scully finally lost his temper. A childhood stutter that had not afflicted him for 20 years started to return. "I don't trust you, and I won't tolerate a lack of trust," he stammered. When Jobs claimed that he would be better than Scully at running the company, Scully took a gamble. He decided to poll the room on that question. "He pulled off this clever maneuver," Jobs recalled, still smarting 35 years later. "It was at the executive committee meeting, and he said, 'It's me or Steve. Who do you vote for?' He set the whole thing up so that you'd kind of have to be an idiot to vote for me." Suddenly, the frozen onlookers began to squirm. Del Yoakum had to go first. He said he loved Jobs, wanted him to continue to play some role in the company, but he worked up the nerve to conclude, with Jobs staring at him, that he respected Scully and would support him to run the company. Eisenstadt faced Jobs directly and said much the same thing. He liked Jobs but was supporting Scully. Regis McKenna, who sat in on senior staff meetings as an outside consultant, was more direct. He looked at Jobs and told him he was not yet ready to run the company, something he had told him before. Others sided with Scully as well. For Bill Campbell, it was particularly tough. He was fond of Jobs and didn't particularly like Scully. His voice quavered a bit as he told Jobs he had decided to support Scully, and he urged the two of them to work it out and find some role for Jobs to play in the company. "You can't let Steve leave this company," he told Scully. Jobs looked shattered. "I guess I know where things stand," he said, and bolted out of the room. No one followed. He went back to his office, gathered his longtime loyalists on the Macintosh staff, and started to cry. He would have to leave Apple, he said. As he started to walk out the door, Debbie Coleman restrained him. She and the others urged him to settle down and not do anything hasty. He should take the weekend to regroup. Perhaps there was a way to prevent the company from being torn apart. Scully was devastated by his victory. Like a wounded warrior, he retreated to Eisenstadt's office and asked the corporate counsel to go for a ride. When they got into Eisenstadt's Porsche, Scully lamented, "I don't know whether I can go through with this." When Eisenstadt asked what he meant, Scully responded, "I think I'm going to resign." "You can't," Eisenstadt protested. "Apple will fall apart." "I'm going to resign," Scully declared. "I don't think I'm right for the company." "I think you're copping out," Eisenstadt replied. "You've got to stand up to him." Then he drove Scully home. Scully's wife was surprised to see him back in the middle of the day. "I've failed," he said to her forlornly. She was a volatile woman who had never liked Jobs or appreciated her husband's infatuation with him. So when she heard what had happened, she jumped into her car and sped over to Jobs's office. Informed that he had gone to the Good Earth restaurant, she marched over there and confronted him in the parking lot as he was coming out with loyalists on his Macintosh team. "Steve, can I talk to you?" she said. His jaw dropped. "Do you have any idea what a privilege it has been even to know someone as fine as John Scully?" she demanded. He averted his gaze. "Can't you look me in the eyes when I'm talking to you?" she asked. But when Jobs did so, giving her his practiced, unblinking stare, she recoiled. "Never mind. Don't look at me," she said. "When I look into most people's eyes, I see a soul. When I look into your eyes, I see a bottomless pit, an empty hole, a dead zone." Then she walked away. Saturday, May 25th. Mike Murray drove to Jobs' house in Woodside to offer some advice. He should consider accepting the role of being a new product visionary, starting Apple Labs, and getting away from headquarters. Jobs seemed willing to consider it. But first he would have to restore peace with Scully. So he picked up the telephone and surprised Scully with an olive branch. Could they meet the following afternoon, Jobs asked, and take a walk together in the hills above Stanford University? They had walked there in the past, in happier times, and maybe on such a walk they could work things out. Jobs did not know that Scully had told Eisenstadt he wanted to quit, but by then it didn't matter. Overnight he had changed his mind and decided to stay. Despite the blow-up the day before, he was still eager for Jobs to like him. So he agreed to meet the next afternoon. If Jobs was prepping for conciliation, it didn't show in the choice of movie he wanted to see with Murray that night. He picked Patton, the epic of the Never Surrender General. But he had lent his copy of the tape to his father, who had once ferried troops for the general, so he drove to his childhood home with Murray to retrieve it. His parents weren't there, and he didn't have a key. They walked around to the back, checked for unlocked doors or windows, and finally gave up. The video store didn't have a copy of Patton in stock, so in the end, he had to settle for watching the 1983 film adaptation of Harold Pinter's Betrayal. Sunday, May 26th. As planned, Jobs and Scully met in back of the Stanford campus on Sunday afternoon and walked for several hours amid the rolling hills and horse pastures. Jobs reiterated his plea that he should have an operational role at Apple. This time Scully stood firm. "It won't work," he kept saying. Scully urged him to take the role of being a product visionary with a lab of his own, but Jobs rejected this as making him into a mere figurehead. Defying all connection to reality, he countered with the proposal that Scully give up control of the entire company to him. "Why don't you become chairman and I'll become president and chief executive officer?" he suggested. Scully was struck by how earnest he seemed. "Steve, that doesn't make any sense," Scully replied. Jobs then proposed that they split the duties of running the company, with him handling the product side and Scully handling marketing and business. But the board had not only emboldened Scully, it had ordered him to bring Jobs to heel. "One person has got to run the company," he replied. "I've got the support, and you don't." On his way home, Jobs stopped at Mike Markula's house. He wasn't there, so Jobs left a message asking him to come to dinner the following evening. He would also invite the core of loyalists from his Macintosh team. He hoped that they could persuade Markula of the folly of siding with Scully.